portrayed him as a freedom fighter. He was the hero standing up against the evil Aristide, according to the West. And so they supported him. And he would say later that he was actually being funded by the CIA and so on. And then as soon as, what happened, once they remove Aristide, what you have is they tried to integrate these former armed military groups into the Haitian National Police because Aristide had disbanded the army. And so what you have is that's why I say we have to call these paramilitaries, because these are former armed groups that actually were funded by outsiders to oust our democratically elected president. And here we are, Guy Philippe was arrested by the US and put in prison for drug trafficking. And we have to understand this because even during his trial, there are certain things that were kept secret because it implicated the US government. And so he served 6 years in prison as a criminal in the US. And now the US dumped him in Haiti in November 2023. After serving 6 year of a 9 year term. And so now he's back running around saying he wants to be president. And he's getting, you're saying Haiti's, everyone pretends that Haiti, are saying that Haiti's at war and so on and so forth. But the reality is, Guy Philippe is giving interviews to all the mainstream press. Guy Philippe gives more interviews than the local people who are organizing against repression. We don't hear them in the Washington Post, but we hear Guy Philippe. So I wonder what the U.S. role is for Guy Philippe right now. And as far as I'm concerned, he should be tried for treason because he was behind, he worked with the U.S. to actually remove our elected president. And so we have to be very careful about what the U.S. is bringing, what the mainstream media is bringing to us as real and as a situation when we know the situation is actually very much controlled by the U.S. and the core group when it comes to Haiti.
And Cherizier, known as Barbecue, the leader of one of the most powerful armed groups, explain his role right now and the alliance that has been formed between the armed groups and also really, is it true for the very first time, sort of forming an alliance with the elite as well, at least agreeing that Ariel Henry should be ousted?
Yes, apparently it seems like Cherizier has joined in with all the other groups that they were in having trouble with. And so it is a combination of all kinds of groups that had worked against one another, that had fought against one another, and now they're coming together to get rid of Henri. And I think part of the problem is I think they're afraid of this supposedly Kenyan-led but US pushed Kenyan mission of 1,000 police officers coming in, another foreign invasion, and they're worried about their position in Haitian society. I do think the elite have to be brought into this, the oligarch of Haiti that are funding this and supporting this, because this nonstop ammunition comes from somewhere. They're coming from these ports that are owned by the elites. And so there might be we don't know who the machinations behind these gangs, who's paying for them. Who, we know that they broke into the ports and emptied some containers, and we don't know what they took, but we know that the ports are not owned by the people, they're owned by the oligarchs. And so what's going on in Haiti is actually very important because I don't think it's a plan that the US wanted, which is why they rushed Henri to Kenya to sign this bilateral agreement after the Kenyan courts said that it was unconstitutional for Kenya to send its police to Haiti. But I think things changed faster than they anticipated. And so now they're scrambling for a new plan in Haiti. And in the meantime, what's happening is our people that are the people, the poor people on the ground are the ones suffering.
Well, Jimmy McPierre, we want to thank you so much for your analysis, professor at the Social Justice Institute at the University of British Columbia in Canada, was before that at UCLA, and is research associate at the University of Johannesburg, a Haitian American scholar, and co-coordinator of the Black Alliance for Peace's Haiti Americas team, which has been closely following the crisis in Haiti. We'll link to your piece in NACLA, Haiti as Empire's Laboratory. When we come back, guilty. That's the verdict on the former president of Honduras, convicted of cocaine trafficking after a U.S. 2-week trial. We'll go to Tegucigalpa for the latest and look at the role of the U.S. in propping him up. Back in 20 seconds.
Chile, Babe, Jalea Divo,
Yalifu by Aurelio Martinez, a Honduran musician. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez was found guilty Friday of cocaine trafficking following a two-week trial here in New York. Prosecutors accused him of ruling Honduras as a narco state, accepting millions of dollars in bribes from cocaine traffickers in exchange for protection, including deploying the Honduran National Police to safeguard cocaine loads as they were transported through Honduras. Ahead of the trial in February, the former head of Honduras's National Police, Juan Carlos El Tigre Bonilla, pleaded guilty to cocaine trafficking charges. Celebrations erupted after Friday's verdict. This is Honduran activist speaking outside Manhattan's federal courthouse.
We are satisfied because justice has been done. Honduras is a country thirsty for justice, where impunity has prevailed. And unfortunately, we Hondurans have to come to foreign countries to ask for justice because it does not exist there, since the bodies for justice, the public ministry, prosecutor's office, judicial power, continue to collude with organized crime. The rotten political class we have has brought the country to total collapse. And everyone we see here, this entire community thirsting for justice, is a clear example of a society in total collapse that has been trampled on and sunk by corrupt politicians.
During the trial, several convicted drug traffickers testified against Hernandez, including some affiliated with the Sinaloa cartel and the son of another former U.S.-backed Honduran president, Porfirio Pepe Lobo Sosa. One confidential witness alleged officials with the Israeli embassy in Colombia were involved in the drug scheme and helped launder millions of dollars that were transferred from Honduras. Hernandez served as president of Honduras from 2014 to 2022. He was a longtime U.S. ally despite mounting reports of human rights violations and accusations of corruption involvement with drug smuggling. He was arrested less than a month after his presidential term ended and was extradited to the United States. His brother, Tony Hernandez, is already serving a life sentence in the U.S. for drug smuggling. Juan Orlando Hernandez faces life in prison now that he's convicted. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Honduras' capital, Tegucigalpa, we're joined by Camilo Bermudez, a member of the Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, the organization founded by Berta Cáceres, the Lenca Indigenous Environmental Defender, who was assassinated in 2016 while Hernandez was president. And we're joined by Dana Frank, professor of history emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz, author of The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror in the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. She attended Juan Orlando Hernandez's trial here in New York. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Frank, you were here in New York when we last spoke to you. You were going each day to the trial. Talk about the significance of this conviction and the testimony that was provided to convict him.
Well, you know, it's an incredible vindication of what Hondurans and so many of us have known since Juan Orlando was first elected, and in fact, since the 2009 military coup overthrowing President Zelaya that the U.S. backed. I mean, the evidence was chilling, and it was very hard for all of us to sit there every day and listen to this litany of assassinations of prosecutors, assassinations of journalists, corruption of the police, the military, politicians, the president, his brother, you name it. And it was like the curtain was drawn back and you could see the day-to-day workings of this tremendous, violent, corrupt mechanism that was the Juan Orlando Hernandez administration, but also that of Pepe Lobo, as you said, before him. And all of this was what happened after the 2009 coup that opened the door for the destruction of the rule of law in Honduras. So it was, you know, very sobering to listen to. And, you know, we were just terrified with which way the jury was going to go. And so it's a great thing, with very complicated caveats about the U.S. role in all this, it's a great thing that he was convicted, legitimating what Hondurans know. But we can talk about what it means that it was the U.S. that did it.
Well, let's talk about what it means that the U.S. did it. I mean, Democracy Now!, we went on the plane from Nicaragua to Honduras with the Zelayas, with Mel Zelaya, who was the president who was deposed in a coup, and his wife, Xiomara, who's currently the president of Honduras, when they returned to Honduras.
You know, the United States, that this all flows back to the 2009 coup, which the U.S. supported the stabilization of it. It supported a completely bogus election a few months after that. And it supported the Juan Orlando when he, first of all, it didn't say a beep when, as president of Congress, he overthrew the Supreme Court in 2012. The U.S. legitimated his the fraudulent 2013 election. You can see step by step by step how the U.S. continued to endorse this illegal regime. Most obviously in 2017, when he was supposedly reelected, it was very clear that he stole the election. And international observers were saying, you need another election, you need to redo this, and the U.S. legitimated him. So the U.S. kept Juan Orlando in power for all those 8 years, but it also legitimated and celebrated him. It sent hundreds of millions of dollars in military and security aid. You know, and I want to underscore, that was the Obama administration. It was Biden celebrating him when he was vice president. It was Trump, and it was Biden again as president. And so it's a long and devastating story of what happened to the Honduran people. You know, and I want to underscore that Juan Orlando was not just a drug trafficker and moving arms. I mean, he was a criminal on a vast scale. As I said, not only did he support the coup and the overthrow of the Supreme Court, he ran for reelection completely illegally and violation of the Constitution. He and his party stole at least $300 million from the National Health Service for his 2013 election, bankrupting it and leading to the deaths of tens of thousands of people. I mean, many are the crimes of Juan Orlando Hernandez, not just those narrowly defined by the Southern District of New York as having imported cocaine and arms into the United States.
Camila Bermudez, you're on the ground in Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras right now, member of the Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, founded by the assassinated environmental indigenous leader, Berta Cáceres, assassinated during the tenure of President Orlando Hernandez. Can you talk about the response on the ground when people heard the verdict on Friday?
Hi, Amy. Thank you for the invitation, of course. Well, the reaction in Honduras to the verdict against Juan Orlando is multiple. Honduran people are still trying to process this news and all the information that the trial has brought to light. The majority feeling is satisfaction, a feeling of progress in achieving justice for a people that has suffered much from the state violence and very high rates of poverty and precariousness led by the Juan Orlando Hernandez government and the National Party. Of course, many are worried about why it had happened in the U.S. and not in Honduras, and why this says about the Honduran justice system and what is going to happen next. Of course, some sectors are trying to minimize this verdict, others such as popular evangelical pastors and the traditional media. And of course, Juan Orlando's close circle are trying to create doubt and criticism about the conviction and evidence against Ho. But organizations as COPIN, who we denounced for many years, all the criminal action of Juan Orlando, we are convinced about these convictions and his guilt. Many of us are raising questions about why the U.S. government, knowing this information from at least 2015, continued to support Juan Orlando's authoritarian regime, even when he ran for an unconstitutional re-election in 2017.
What's so interesting is this is an election year in the United States. Immigration is one of the major issues, if not the primary issue. Many Hondurans have tried to flee to the United States, fleeing what had become in Honduras a narco state with the help of the United States. Camilo Bermudez, do people make that connection in Honduras? And how do they feel about the draconian immigrant response, the crackdown on people trying to cross the border, given what the U.S. has done in creating that situation?
Well, I think that people do the connections about how this state of Honduras has become a narco state or a state run by criminals. But it's not that easy to make the connection about the U.S. Like now the U.S. Has, or the U.S. government has come as an heroic act of going after Juan Orlando, and is difficult to read how this impacts on the public. We remember, several organizations remember, that during the Juan Orlando regime, multiple social leaders were assassinated, multiple cases, vast cases of corruptions, vast cases of dispossession for indigenous lands, and well, it's of course known that the condemnation of Juan Orlando as head of an organized crime and drug trafficking structure is a step forward. However, we could not have done this without the support, or he could not have done this without the support of the private companies and financial institutions. And many people are wondering, what are the investigations against that? What are the processes against that? What are the processes behind all the violence that has come to a result of people leaving Honduras?
And finally, Professor Frank, what happens next? When is the sentencing? And I mean, we just finished a whole segment on Haiti that is in total turmoil, with not the same details, but similar U.S. shoring up of coup regimes.
Well, you know, exactly. I was thinking about the previous speaker and the phrase U.S. imperial machinations. This has been going on, well, of course, through all of 20th century Honduran history. But, you know, what happens next is, you know, he can appeal. Nobody thinks he's going to win on appeal. His sentencing hearing is June 26th in New York. The minimum sentence is 40 years, and he can get three life sentences. So he's 55 years old. He's going to be in jail for till he's 95 at the very least. And, you know, I guess you want, I just, you know, in terms of what happens next, it's not the United States or the Biden administration that was wanting to get rid of Juan Orlando. It was the Southern District of New York that followed the money, followed the drugs, and did this. And Biden administration and Trump administration kicking, and Obama administration kicking and screaming all the way. So, you know, right now, Xiomara Castro, the president of Honduras, the center-left president who was elected by the biggest landslide in Honduran history, a little over 2 years ago, she faces tremendously devastated government and economy. You know, it's, they're making progress there, and it's incredible challenges that she and her government are facing, and they don't control the Congress. What is the United States going to do? They haven't said a peep. The State Department has not said a peep. And the ambassador, Dogu, who just loves to tweet out attacking the Honduran government, all she did was repeat what the Southern District of New York had said. You know, the pattern in the last 2 years since Xiomara came into office is this, that the U.S. has been repeatedly trying to undermine her and to undermine the reforms that she's put through or tried to put through of the tax system, of the electrical system, trying to push back the corruption of all the post-coup years. And it's shameless the way the United States is continuing to work with the National Party, which is so established to be full of drug traffickers and criminals. The president of the current president of the National Party, which is
10 seconds,
justice. You know, and so the U.S. has been supporting the National Party in every way it can and acting like it's an equal actor with Libre. So is the U.S. going to apologize? Is it going to pay reparations? Is it going to change its way? Is it going to acknowledge what it did? And we have to hold the United States government accountable, as the U.S. Congress has repeatedly tried to do.
Dana Frank, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor of History Emerita, University of California, Santa Cruz, and Camilo Bermudez, Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, founded by the assassinated leader Berta Cáceres, the organization called COPIN. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, report from Gaza in 20 seconds. And Phineas O'Connell singing What Was I Made For, the theme song for the movie Barbie, last night at the Oscars Awards. They won the Oscar for Best Original Song. During their speech, Billy and Phineas were wearing Artists for Ceasefire pins for Gaza. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's continuing its attacks on Gaza as Palestinians mark the first day of Ramadan. The death toll from Israel's five-month assault has topped 31,000. For more on the situation on the ground in Gaza, we turn to part two of our conversation with the Palestinian novelist, poet, and activist Susan Abu Hawa. She is the author of a number of books, including her debut novel, Mornings in Jenin. She's founder and co-director of Playgrounds for Palestine, a children's group, and the executive director of Palestine Rights Literature Festival. She joined us last week from Cairo, Egypt, one day after she returned from a two-week trip to Gaza. I asked her about the level of trauma that the children in Gaza are experiencing.
The trauma is immeasurable, frankly, not just for children, but for everybody. I spoke with a lot of women in particular who were recovering in a hospital or were there being with their children who were recovering. The stories they told me are out of like a Hollywood horror film. I mean, I have photos of the backs of men where Israeli soldiers carved pictures, smiley faces, stars of David, etc., in their skin. These women narrated stories to me of, Israeli soldiers laying hundreds of women on the ground and then taking their guns with the laser and laughing, and then wherever the laser landed, they shoot. I spoke with a woman whose three-year-old daughter had both of her legs shattered, and she was in the hospital recovering. It was an intentional, she was intentionally shot by a soldier. And this happened to her daughter after they killed her son, shot him through the head in what she described as tank fire, toying with them for about 30 minutes before they finally delivered the final blow that took her son. People being forced to walk from hospitals, severe injuries, people being forced to walk for hours to get to safety, children in people in you know who were fleeing their homes trying to get to the south, having to walk with their hands up with their IDs, and if anybody dares to look down or pick anything up, they're picked off. They're literally shot by snipers. The scenes that they narrated to me, I spoke with a little girl who was about 8 years old, whose face was badly burned, but her injuries were the least in the whole family. The entire family had third degree burns all over their bodies. And what she explained to me, I don't know how a child survives that. I spent time in a hospital in a maternity ward where there were newborns who were unknown, or who were known but whose family was just absent and no longer there, or nobody knows what happened to them. These newborns are spending 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in incubators without any human touch, really, except when they come to feed them, because the nurses and the doctors are so exhausted and so overworked. People are being discharged from hospitals with wounds and going into tents where they don't have running water and proper hygiene, and they're getting horrible infections and dying from sepsis. Life on the beach, the beaches where Palestinians used to go for fun, to love, to be with family, and it's torture now because a lot of tents are pitched in the sand, and the sand is in everything. That people's skin is scorched. I mean, children walk around with cracked cheeks from the sun and sand. The sand gets in every bite of food. The food that does come into Rafah is primarily canned food, and most of it, and I think you hinted at this earlier, and I've seen it and tasted it myself, it is stuff that has clearly been sitting on shelves for decades. And all you can taste really is the rancidity, metallic taste of the can. People schedule their days, they plan their days around trying to get to a single shared bathroom that's shared by hundreds of other families. They try to do their best with hygiene, but it's impossible. And when people succumb to living in filth, people, I think maybe people in the West sort of have this impulse thought that most Black and brown people sort of live like this. So it's a little humiliating to have to explain that we don't actually live in filth, and it's degrading beyond anything you can imagine to be forced to live like this months on end, to have no way to protect your children, no way to give them hope, no way to calm their fears. There's no privacy in the tents, because there's not enough tents for families. So families are actually separated with dozens of women in one tent and dozens in another. So spouses cannot even hold each other at night when they need that care the most. It's these details that are traumatizing en masse for children, for parents, for elderly. People don't have medicines. People are dying from lack of insulin, which, by the way, Israel has banned from coming into Gaza. And they're dying from diarrhea because they're drinking polluted water. And Israel has also banned water treatment, water filtration systems, even handheld ones, simple personal water filtration systems that, Americans use when they go camping. The degradation is total, Amy. And on top of that, they're bombed day in and out, even in Rafah. When I was there, there was not a single night that we didn't hear bombs. And at least once was close enough that the building I was in shook, and we thought our building had actually been hit, but it was the one, it was one over from where I was. And there was another moment, too, when a tent by a hospital where we had just been was bombed. They bombed a tent, and it actually happened to be the tent that is adjacent to the tent that Bisan Ode was in, and they were sitting eating. They were sitting on the ground eating, and shrapnel just came above their heads.
Palestinian novelist, poet, and activist Susan Abulhawa. Her debut novel, Mornings in Jenin, was translated into 32 languages. She joined us last week from Cairo, Egypt, one day after she returned from Gaza. To see parts one and two of our interview with her, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
How can you protect your keys? Simply attach a Waramps key tag to your key ring. If you lose your keys, the Waramps can return them to you by courier for free. Waramps key tags, they're free and they work. Order yours at waramps.ca.
If you're a